So, what's a little bit on my mind to talk about is the last Monday, I mentioned the word progress, in, the expression progress in meditation in the talk, and someone at promptly at 9 o'clock, when we were all supposed to go home, said, oh, what do you mean by progress? And progress is kind of like, you know, P word, you're not supposed to, you know, it's not like... It's one of those words that you don't use too much. And so I'm planning tomorrow to give that talk, a little talk about progress. But it's on my mind. And I'll probably say a lot of things today, as I'll say tomorrow. But today, the angle I want to go is a little bit different. And that is, I don't want to answer the question particularly, what is progress? But I want to try to provide a little bit the various Buddhist views or worldviews, context for Buddhist practice. And then depending on the context you hold the practice, you can have different ideas about what progress is. And it's kind of like mindfulness practice is a tool. And it's a neutral tool, and depending how you can use a tool in many different ways. A knife is a tool. In the hands of a surgeon, it's one thing. In the hands of a murderer, it's something else. In the hands of a parent who's preparing meal for family. It's, you know, opening up the package of food with a knife or something. You know, the knife itself is kind of a neutral in a sense, but then you can use it in many different understandings, contexts, intentions. So same thing with mindfulness. And in fact, Buddhists down through the ages, and even today in America and across the world, will understand the context for mindfulness very differently. It lends itself to many different containers. And you can listen to different teachers, and they have a different container. But the practice itself is very neutral, and that's part of its beauty. I thought of kind of trying to say something kind of as a preparation for what I'm going to say by what a little bit I've learned about childbirth. My wife is about to give birth. We're anxiously, we're eagerly waiting for her to start labor. And so it's very much on my mind. And so we've been preparing ourselves a little bit with reading and various things. And we're kind of latecomers to the whole idea of natural birth because doctors had always insisted that she had to have a C-section, a planned C-section. And in fact, she had one, a date scheduled for October 17th. But the... 3 weeks ago, the doctor said, oh, no, you can try to have it naturally, because somehow he had a different opinion. And so that's all new. Suddenly we have to, you know, we hadn't been thinking about this as a possibility. And so I've been learning more about this particular human phenomena event. And I kind of had this kind of very, very amateurish or uninformed kind of view of the history of in the West of child birthing. And there was a time, seemingly, that in Western medicine that a woman giving birth was considered to be very passive. And the doctor knew everything, and you know, you put yourself up on this table with stirrups, which turns out to be one of the worst positions for giving birth. But that's kind of, you know, a very passive kind of situation. And then they loved the idea of all these medicines they could give you, epidurals and numb you out in various ways. And that was considered great progress to be able to have the birth be pain-free and the woman not feel much below the waist. And mostly it was just a passive event. You showed up and the doctor took over. And then probably in the 70s or so, and as a kind of movement in the West, in America, was a whole thing of Lamas training classes and preparation for birth and learning how to breathe and all that. And so women kind of, you know, got more empowered in learning how to cultivate themselves, develop themselves, prepare themselves for this event and take more responsibility and be more involved in the whole process and not to be passive in the whole, in it. And maybe some of you have gone through that, those kinds of classes and stuff. And I don't know if this is true or not, but the book that is currently quite popular among the midwives that are telling you should read this book claims that that a lot of women would learn little Ma's breathing technique, these breathing techniques, and they'd show up at to give birth, and they just let go out the window, you know, or you know, and then they would forget about that, and it didn't somehow fit in to what was going on. And some of the women were burdened because they had all these techniques from the 60s and 70s that kind of championed the idea of having a pain-free birth. Like if you did it really well, you breathed really well and deeply, you relaxed and just like, and this book talks about the women who would be there at giving birth and they'd feel like they're personal failures. They'd failing because they were, you know, had these white knuckles and they were just really kind of screaming and it was really painful and difficult. And gee, you know, this was, you know, it wasn't like, you know, they were, you know, they'd done this good work preparing themselves for months and it wasn't like their image of what they prepared themselves for. So they felt like they'd failed in giving childbirth. And since it's so central to some women's identity, is the idea of being, you know, birthing mother, to not have it go right can be very painful and very difficult. And so this book we're reading now talks about, it's really fascinating for me because it says things like, the pain is really important. And you don't want to numb yourself from the pain because there's a lot of internal, you know, feedback systems between the baby and the mother that rely on that pain for information and feedback, for getting the hormones going certain ways. And I don't know, you know, if the vocabulary is accurate or not, but, you know, the book says that the mother starts going into labor, starts creating these hormones to cause the contractions, when the baby's brain creates stress hormones. The poor baby's getting stressed, right? And the baby has to be stressed out in order to produce these hormones, so the mom knows to produce her things to stress out the baby even more. And this is a wonderful system, you know, where this kind of thing, whole thing begins happening. And and we had and the pain is supposed to consider be very useful to help the mother know how to respond in terms of what posture to be in. And I get this, you know, I don't think the only birth I've ever been to was a cow. And it was pretty amazing, but the cows, you know, have only one posture. As far as I can tell. And it seems that the pain of childbirthing is a feedback for the mother to be encouraged to know how to get into the right posture for her. And we had one friend of ours who gave birth this last year. And she was very fortunate. She had a doctor to help deliver. But this doctor, he had studied with midwives. So he knew a lot of the midwife lore and understanding of how this gets done. And he encouraged her. She had something wrong with the way the baby was coming out. It was breech or backwards or something. Backwards. And some years ago, he would have done a C-section. But he'd studied with the midwives. And he said to her, just listen to the pain and put yourself, your body, in the posture your pain seems to tell you to be in, to relieve the pain or do something, respond to the pain. And so she did this, you know, all these strange positions. I don't know, I haven't seen it yet. But these positions are capable, and squatting and whatever. And the baby turned himself around and came out just fine. And the pain was the important feedback for the system to work. So here we have a system that's evolved over, you know, centuries, millennia of pain being an essential element, helpful element in the whole process. And if we feel that pain is wrong and bad and somehow we should stop having the pain, we short-circuit the whole way the system has been organized to make the process work. So we have a passive approach. We have the preparation approach, you know, and then we have the system. The body knows what's best, and trust it. Just go along with what's already there. One of the things this book says is that it's healthy to worry. That a mother who's not worried is in trouble. I mean, there can be excessive worrying. You can worry too much, but worry is this book considers a very healthy part of the whole system because it kind of helps you get kind of concerned and involved and kind of really present for the event, hopefully in a healthy way. So here's this book that kind of says everything that you normally would do worry and feel pain and is all kind of healthy part of the system. Trust it. Trust your body. Trust your reactions and your instincts. And be supported in that and go along with it. And in that support, you, the thing will happen. Something will be born. So what does this have to do with mindfulness? With Buddhist practice? I think kind of similar approaches can be seen towards a human life. Some people take human life as being a passive event. You just go along. You go along and you know, the experts will tell you what to do. Your parents, your school teachers, your bosses, whatever. And you just kind of follow along. And the more passive you can be, the you know, who are you to make any decisions ultimately? You come and hear great spiritual teachers, you know, who have the great answers to what you should do. And you're just, great, you know, someone knows, and I'm just going to go along with what someone else says. And so various passive approaches is one strategy people take. If you read the early discourses of the Buddha, the whole early tradition of Buddhism, continuing down into the Theravadan tradition today of Southeast Asia, this kind of tradition that we come out of our center, it's almost entirely about cultivating yourself, developing yourself. Personal, not personal, the right word, expression maybe, but because associations with the West now, personal development. But the word for practice, for there's no word for meditation in particular. The word is bhavana, and the bhavana means cultivation. Like you'd cultivate a field. You cultivate and develop something. And the understanding is that there's this potential that you have. Like you, and you can develop that potential. So you can develop your potential to get concentrated. You have a potential to develop equanimity. You have a potential to develop your capacity for joy. You have a potential to develop your capacity for mindfulness. And it's all like, kind of like muscles. And you're all born with this muscle. And if you want that muscle to become strong and support you, you have to develop. You have to go to the gym and work out. And there's a tremendous capacity to develop that we all have to develop these muscles. Most of us never develop them to a great degree. Some people do. Certain professions, musicians perhaps develop concentration. You know, different professions you develop different kinds of skills. These muscles get developed. People who devote themselves to Buddhist practice, like monks and nuns who do it kind of full time, have often the opportunity, not always, but occasionally they take the opportunity to use that lifestyle to develop these muscles to a great potential, a great degree. When we go on retreat, we're developing these muscles. And there's a whole range of them. Patience is one. And so in the Vipassana tradition, for example, retreats is one of the ways we develop our potential to be mindful. We're continually developing and applying ourselves. And whether you know it or not, you're kind of developing this muscle, developing this ability. And it becomes a strength you can carry with you into your life. And in different situations, you find yourself now, you're mindful in a situation, whereas before you were not. There are people who I meet, maybe you're some of them, it's not a moral flaw, but just people I meet, who seem to not be aware of their thinking, that they're thinking while they're thinking. They're aware after the fact. They kind of remember, oh, I was thinking about something. But they're kind of not so aware of the thinking process while they're involved. If you cultivate your mindfulness and develop that capacity, you'll start becoming, that muscle is strong enough, you start noticing that you're thinking while you're thinking. And that gives you tremendous freedom of choice and wisdom in relationship to what your thoughts are. So it's something you can cultivate and develop. The early tradition focused on this, early Buddhist tradition, almost entirely. It was understood that the ultimate experience of freedom was not something you could cultivate. You couldn't make it happen. It was uncultivatable. However, it was something that you prepared for. And so you kind of did all this work to prepare yourself, develop a great capacity, develop your capacity to a great degree. And when your equanimity, your concentration, your joy, your well-being was very well established, your inner life, then the mind would be relaxed enough, would be at home enough, comfortable enough to do that ultimate letting go that is necessary for liberation. Then as Buddhism developed in India and China, in India, especially in the Mahayana tradition, they developed the idea of a Buddha nature. And it's a whole topic in itself, and there's many different ideas of Buddha nature. But part of the idea of Buddha nature is that it's not all about what you have to do, your cultivation, your preparation. But there is an innate capacity of the system to self-organize itself, to self-heal itself, to self-liberate itself. The psyche, the inner life, the spiritual life, whatever, given half a chance, will organize itself, will in the direction of liberation. So the kind of more of the idea, you almost have to get out of the way. Some the Buddha nature philosophy, you have to get out of the way to let this kind of come forth, come through. Some philosophies of Buddha nature says you still have to cultivate that potential, but there's some innate goodness in there that is innate in who you are, that is self-organizing. I mean, very simplistically, you know, if you cut your finger, you can focus on all the things you have to do to heal it. Keep it clean and put a bandage on it and put antibiotics on it and keep it elevated. And there's all these things you could do. Eat, you know, good food or whatever you do, rest. But there's, you know, if you do your work of covering it with a bandage and keeping it clean, there's a self-healing aspect of the body. Well, it'll heal that cut. It's phenomenal. You can't will the healing to happen. You can't make it happen. You can't orchestrate it. You can't design it. It's like this amazing thing that happens. There's a self-healing aspect of, you know, the body with a cut. There's also self-healing aspects of the psyche when we have emotional wounds. We often don't allow that to happen because we often, you know, keep it very, you know, we keep kind of putting salt in the wound, or we keep, you know, we keep being concerned about it, or we're afraid of it, or we re-traumatize ourselves by keeping re-angry, or the various things that we do that sometimes doesn't allow us to relax and let the psyche self-heal, that sometimes it can do. And then there's a self-liberating movement of the spiritual life also, that the Buddha nature kind of philosophy champions. That it's the innate desire, it's the innate movement, it's the innate, what wants to be expressed within us, is for the psyche to find itself liberated, to become free. And one of the ways I understand it is this example that I've given often. I won't make you go through it, those of you who have gone through it so many times with me. But, you know, if you hold your fist really, really tight and try to hold it really tight for 5 minutes, and just hard as you can, you'll find the fist, in order to keep it that tight, you have to keep reapplying, making new effort to hold it really tight. Because the natural thing that the tight fist wants to do is to be released, is to relax. Holding, this spiritual holding that Buddhism is supposed to free ourselves from, the way in which our heart is held tight or restricted or contracted, it naturally itself, it wants to release just like the fist does. It is a self-liberating movement towards any ways in which we hold ourselves enslaved or not free. So the Buddha nature approach is that there's an innate movement towards these things, innate movement towards compassion, towards love. It's the tendency of the system. It's not something you have to cultivate. It's not all about you doing and orchestrating, but there's some kind of way in which you have to allow, there's a natural process within you that wants to give birth to something. Now these two approaches don't have to be held separate from each other. You can, and that's part of the beauty, is that you can cultivate yourself and develop yourself and have the understanding that something's being born through you that's not exactly of your doing. You have to get out of the way. You have to listen very carefully, be very sensitive to what is it that wants to come through you, and get in the right posture, you know. whatever that is. And so my wife is getting ready to give birth. We'll see, but she puts a lot of confidence or faith or trust in all her years of meditation practice, what she's learned, both in terms of and yoga practice, in terms of breathing and meditation and being with physical pain, and she that inner life. She feels she has a really strong foundation there, and I'm pretty confident she does too. So she wants to call on that, and my job is to be there and support her and be there with her with that. So she's relying on her cultivation, but she doesn't know what she's going to do. Not like she's going to try some special kind of breathing technique, particularly. She's going to be really present. So she feels she's prepared herself for something which she can't know what's going to happen. Does that make sense? So this thing's going to, So those two things both apply. So what is your relationship to your capacities that you have to develop? What is your capacity to your potentials? Some people are traumatized by any idea that you have to develop yourself, or you can develop yourself, because it's a setup for failure. All kinds of notions that, I can't do it come into play. Comparative thoughts that come into play. Well, if I'm trying to do it, I'm doing it a little bit, but this guy next to me, he's doing really well, and therefore I'm a failure. And someone had yesterday at the one-day sitting, had this great T-shirt, or a sweatshirt or something. In the back it said, it was some kind of fitness center, I think. I thought it was great. And it said, personal best fitness center, something like that. Mark's not. And the idea of personal best I loved, because you're not comparing yourself to anybody else. Just, what's your personal best? It's kind of like this joyful approach, trying to try to get to my personal best. So what's your relationship to your capacity to develop yourself? Traditionally in Buddhism, in early Buddhist tradition, one of the things you're tracking, are you developing your concentration? Are you living a lifestyle that supports the development of that capacity? Are you developing your capacity for loving kindness? Are you developing that capacity for becoming more mindful? And you can kind of track and follow and notice, how you develop it over the days and weeks and years. You can kind of sometimes get a sense of momentum going. Oh, yeah, this is happening. And it's very interesting to track it, and very inspiring sometimes to track it and be involved in it. But is it also then valuable to have some sense of some unknown process, some innate process that's happening that's not of your doing, that you have to get out of the way of and allow it to happen? Sooner or later, in the traditional view of the path of cultivation, you have to get out of the way, because the nirvana is uncultivatable. You can't do anything to make it happen. So you have to give up. Sooner or later, you have to give up any attempt to kind of cultivate yourself or do or make something happen. Some Buddhist traditions want you to stop doing, give up any attempt to try to make something happen earlier rather than later. And some later rather than earlier. It depends on the whole view and understanding. And they're all right. And that's what the beauty of it all. So my approach, having studied all this, is that there's a way in which we can understand all of them as being right and skillful and useful. They all have some angle on what is actually true for the human being, human psyche. There are times when you want to be passive, giving birth. If you have a medical emergency, you're going to be passive. They put you under. And that's appropriate. That's what's going to happen. It's appropriate to cultivate and develop yourself some way, I think. And it's appropriate to understand that there's some innate expression of liberation inside of you that wants to come forth and wants to come out. Are you still following me? Okay. So I want to give a last... So I'm kind of a little bit complicated here, but I'm giving kind of there's the un-Buddhist approach of being totally passive. That's what people were like before they came to spiritual practice, in theory. Then there's a path of cultivation. Then there's a path of the Buddha nature, something innate within us, which can be brought forth, which wants to come forth, which is coming forth, but it's still something which may be dormant within us. It's a potential, innate potential, Buddha. It's a seed within us that something beautiful, something innate. The early tradition had no sense of something innate within us that wanted to come, be born, come forth, self-healing, self-organizing. So, path of cultivation, the Buddha nature idea. And then when you come to Japan, you had a very different kind of development in Buddhism. It's very uniquely Japanese, perhaps. And here you have something called Hongaku Shiso in Japanese, which is the thought or philosophy of original enlightenment. And this is the idea that it isn't a matter that you have an original enlightenment within you which is there to be revealed, or you know, but rather that the whole expression of the phenomenal world, the trees, the carpet here, the lights which are off, the lights which are on out there, the wind, the particular thought you're having right now listening to this, sensations of your body right now as they are, your impatience, your excited, what is he going to say now? You know, everything in the phenomenal world is the expression of original enlightenment, is itself, to say it in some way, is expression of perfection. Is the way the whole, that the way the Japanese wanted to say it, original, the world is itself is, as it is, enlightened. Original enlightenment is already here in every single phenomenal expression that's happening right now. So there's no idea of cultivating, no idea of giving birth to something inside of you that's there ready to be birthed, be born. It's already been born, it's already here, as it is. And practice then, one understanding of practice in this original enlightenment kind of philosophy is that you don't practice in order to do anything. You practice because practice is what wants to happen. Practice is the natural expression of the perfection of this very moment. It's like sometimes if you, I don't know if this is a good example, but I can't think of a good example. Some people see this Japanese approach to Buddhism as being very world-affirming, because it's this world itself. You're not trying to escape the world, which the Indian idea is you're cultivating yourself in order to, and it's not exactly, it's in a certain way you can see it's escaping the world, to no longer, to be in the world but not of the world, to experience the unconditioned, that freedom which is beyond conditions. The Japanese saw that the conditions of the world is itself enlightenment. The danger of this Japanese approach is it lends itself to what's called antinomianism. It lends itself that anything goes. And I saw this in Japan among the monks there who had this philosophy, who had this idea, you know, everything I do is enlightenment, everything is expression of original enlightenment. And and they did rather unusual things. And well, not so unusual, but unusual for Buddhist monks. And maybe it's great that they did this stuff. But I remember one guy who was really into this said, oh, I don't sit at all. I don't meditate at all because everything's in, I did that when I was a young training monk. But I understand now that everything's enlightenment. And so I stay home in my temple. I drink a lot of whiskey and beer. And when I'm free, I had a big Harley Davidson in his garage. I go driving on my Harley Davidson around. A little bit unusual for a monk to have a Harley Davidson drive around. But, you know, it seemed, you know, it's maybe some wisdom behind his understanding, but it seemed a little odd to me. And also, when I was in Japan, the monastery there, they were just struggling a little bit with the legacy of this kind of teaching. Because it was used in Japan to support racial discrimination. Everything's expression of, you know, innate enlightenment. Therefore, the social system as it's set up is also an expression of it. Therefore, it's fine to have these untouchables. In Japanese, bakujin? Burakujin. And in fact, there was all soul searching going on in the Soto Zen system in Japan when I was there, because the Soto Zen monasteries and religious organizations and institutions had for centuries been supporting that whole view, that, you know, that it was that giving the religious justification for having this kind of racial discrimination that they have had traditionally in Japan. So they were, they'd realized this, and when I was in the monasteries in the early, mid-80s, they were doing all this education. And I was, it would come, people would come, professors would come to the monastery and educated us about the history of it and the bad consequences in trying to change the understanding of, you know, this period of Japanese Buddhist history, which was rather, rather unfortunate. So in my view, these different stages or different contexts for mindfulness practice, for Buddhist practice, are responding to very, very deep questions about what it means to be human being. And you might ask yourself, you know, deeply, you know, what is it to be a human being? Why are you here? What is human life about? What's the most important thing to do as a human being? Are you passive? Are you just going to go along with, without ever thinking about those? And just go along with what? If you do, then you're just going to be kind of follow just the social conditioning that you've gotten. Or are you going to, you know, if you don't, it's just passive, and really ask yourself these kinds of deep questions, then are there different approaches to spiritual life that it's suitable for you? For your understanding? Is the path of cultivation something that really inspires you? For some people, it's really inspiring. Is the path of innate Buddha nature the path for you? The path of sense of real deep sense of inner potential? Sense of the divinity within or something, Buddha nature within? Or is it that you have some view about not just yourself, human being, what it is to be a human being, but a view of what the cosmos is like, the whole universe, that you that maybe fits into some view of, you know, anything, but it could, for example, fit into the very world-affirming approach, as the Japanese Hongaku Shiso, the original Enlightenment view, is. There's a lot of different understandings, and when people sit to practice mindfulness, to sit and just be attentive in the moment of what's happening. Some people do it passively because they've been told to do that. You should do that. My mother said you should be mindful. But consciously or unconsciously, we bring with us a view of what we're doing when we sit down to be mindful of what's happening in the present moment. What's your view? What's your understanding of what you're doing? And don't just look at it, the conscious view you have, but is there some kind of subconscious or kind of unexamined, a kind of unreflected view that you bring with you about your approach, what you're doing. So that's probably a good place to end, giving you, turning it over to you. No? I see someone's head.
Just noticing now, often because there's 7 minutes to fill up, one tends to.
Oh, because you're taking the you're taping.
No, just noticing speakers. Some use every minute. Some go over. Some stop.
Oh.
Just love you.
I say, what profound understanding of human life. But so anyway, would any of you like to ask a question or comment? Or so, yes?
If everything is enlightenment, it seems that makes me a little nervous. Because it seems to me that there has to be a contrast for it to have any meaning. You could equally say everything is unenlightenment. If everything is A, everything is also B. Am I making myself clear?
Yeah.
So it loses all of its meaning. There's no inherent meaning in enlightenment if everything is enlightenment, mm-hmm. unless there's a little something somewhere.
Right. So what you find in certain strands of Soto Zen is that faith becomes very important. Soto Zen is partly very much a faith tradition, where you have faith in this. And so the question is whether you have faith, deep faith in this or not. And so if you have faith in it, then you relax into this as a possibility, and it's, you know, and your life is transformed in some way. So the Zen Master Dogen said, foolish people or ordinary people are deluded about enlightenment. Enlightened people are enlightened about delusion. So there's a difference there. But the difference is that someone who sees it this way really sees everything as being perfect. So the question is, do you see it that way or don't you see it that way? And some teachers then will say, it's that way whether you know it or not. But it's helpful to know it. It's a whole... Yes?
I guess what I'm saying is similar to what I was saying is, how would the Japanese view things like war and hatred and violence?
Well, I don't want to speak so much for this tradition, right? I don't know. I can't say I know that much. I mean, I told you a little bit about this, you know, this discrimination aspect that existed there, and how there's a book called Zen at War that talks a little bit about how the Zen tradition used some of the religious philosophy to support the war effort. So there's, you know, there is ways that, but that's true also in Thailand, you know, in Burma, and different people have used Buddhism to support different war efforts. It's not unique to the Japanese. And I think the people I know who I have most respect for, who are deeply enmeshed in this kind of worldview of practice, have very deep faith in the goodness of the human heart. And if there is a radical acceptance of the perfection of this life itself, that itself will ensure that you'll respond to the world in the appropriate way. So the understanding that most of the ways in which we act inappropriately in the world come from not understanding the innate perfection, come from not accepting life very deeply as it is. And so if you do this very deep acceptance that this particular view has, then there's the real deep faith and trust that this is, you know, you'll respond and act in the appropriate way. That's part of it. But I was trained for a long time in the Soto Zen tradition. I feel very home in this view, the Hongakushi, the original enlightenment view. And but it's a little bit hard for me to articulate exactly how, you know, maybe someday I'll be able to articulate exactly how it is for me, but it has to do with a certain understanding of what it is to be a human being in this universe, in this cosmos. You know, is there some other, you know, if you don't have a focus on heaven, some world beyond, if this is the only world we have, is this world we live, this cosmos, this universe we're in? What is our relationship to this world? Who are we in this world? And I think of all the different Buddhist schools, it's the Japanese Kamakura schools of Buddhism that somehow have the most to teach us, or most to inspire us, or most to somehow challenge us in a very modern view of what it's like to be a human being in the world right now. So I know I didn't say anything much right now, but I wanted to. Someday I'll be able to articulate it. Yes.
It seems to me that even in that view, you're still cultivating faith. I mean, as you practice within that framework, you're still cultivating faith. Your faith deepens.
Right.
So it still seems like a path of cultivation.
Maybe, yes. Or it could be passive cultivation, just kind of faith is self-reinforcing, perhaps. Just arises, it comes along with you as you go along. In the Soto Zen tradition, which I've been part of for many years, I feel it really comes down in the end to faith. You know, faith is a very important part of it. And we don't usually think of Zen as faith being a very important part of Zen. But I think that it's a very, very much a faith tradition. In a very different way than faith is present for the early Buddhist tradition, the Vipassana or the Theravada tradition, where faith is much more has to do with confidence and certain trust and confidence in potential and possibility. It's to use maybe a little poor word, it's much more rational.
A couple of years ago, you were talking about belief in Buddhism, and you talked about the belief in karma. And I discovered that I learn a lot more from my mistakes than I do from the things that I do right. So I feel like even unskillful actions leading to suffering lead toward enlightenment for me. So I can kind of recast the Soto Zen perspective in the light that I'm going to learn more by doing stupid stuff.
Great. Well, then maybe you're in the same school as Zen Master Dogen. He said, a Zen master's life is one continual mistake.
I appreciated your comments about birth because I am a newborn. And we're probably about 3,500 babies now. And birth has been probably the most important spiritual teacher for me. And I would just like to reaffirm what you said about self-organizing, self-directing. Because often it doesn't go over too well when the partner is sitting back thinking this is really cool. and the woman is wanting medication. So it has to come from her, that organizing principle.
Yeah, I'm nervous. How is this going to go? Yes?
I guess I had some thoughts about birth as well.
From a doctor in training, right?
And it's been interesting for me because I feel like we really emphasize in our mindfulness practice opening to our discomfort and our pain. Along retreats, we're encouraged more and more to not move away from that, to not change position right away, and to work with the pain in the knee and the back, and to open to it, to really kind of use that to grow and to strengthen our muscles and to wake up. But I sometimes also wonder if there's a danger in that taken to a certain extreme, we can punish ourselves or judge ourselves for when we do move away from that pain. And it's come up for me in my training because I've always come from more of an alternative medicine or a natural point of view. The first labor attendant was someone who refused to have an epidural and went through without any medications. That was really inspiring. And so that's always been my real bias. But I also have more and more realized that I can't, I'm sure a lot of women in this room have given birth. I'm sure a number have used epidurals. And the more I work with women in that process, the more I realize that there's no wrong way. And there's no way in hell, especially being a man, that I could fault someone for wanting some relief from the pain that can be so intense at times. And yet I do realize that in some circles, there's almost, it can be a sense of, I don't know, self-judgment for actually going for the epidural, going for the pain relief. where they were really in some circumstances it might be the most skillful choice, and maybe just the right thing to allow the person to relax and to deepen into their process. And, so anyways, there's just some thoughts about that and just finding that balance.
I think it's good, yeah. So, you know, that's why I think there's all these different approaches. I think they're all. I like to be very inclusive. You know, all the different approaches actually have a place. So rather than having, you know, one view, one shoe fits all, and be very accepting of, you know, in certain different contexts, different ways of, you know, so there's wisdom, there's wise ways of using anything. There's wise ways of using epidural, wise ways of being with pain, and there's unwise ways of using it. And hopefully we have the wisdom to separate when. So like with my wife, I've talked to her a little bit about, you know, how, you know, when she, you know, when should I listen? when should I listen to her request for epidural, and when should I not? You know, and it's a little very hard. You know, how do you sort that one out? You know, she's yelling at you. You know, give me that epidural. Well, you said. So, you know, but, you know, the idea of let's wait 5 minutes and then we'll reevaluate or something. But, you know, my wife is, you know, she really doesn't want to use epidural, but she's kind of okay with using it. So, you know, the important thing is to have the baby born. And that's what's important. I mean, she's more interested in the healthy baby being born than she is in the particular way the baby's born. And so to tie it back to practice like you did in retreats, I think there's healthy ways of being present for pain and unhealthy ways on retreat or in meditation. And you have to have the mindfulness and the good sense to kind of sort your way through that. And some of it is trial and error. You kind of sometimes learn from your mistakes a little bit. But it's very powerful and very helpful sometimes to sit with physical pain in meditation. Pain shouldn't be seen as being a hindrance or a problem. It's really the door into deeper spiritual life. And sometimes it's actually counterproductive to sit with pain, and it's just the absolutely wrong thing to do, and it's wrong spiritually, it's wrong physically, it's wrong all kind, you know. So what I like to encourage people to do is, if you're in doubt whether it's useful or not, err on the side of being careful. But if you have a good sense that you're not damaging yourself, that this is actually a good part of the process for you, and you're really into it, then go with it. And it can be very intense in meditation. Part of the reason my wife is, part of the resources she's calling on now, giving birth, is she said, it'll be like Tangaryo. Tangaryo is this Zen practice where you sit, I think she did it for 5 days, where you kind of, you're supposed to sit for 5 days and not move. You know, and you're allowed to go to the bathroom. And after each meal, you get 3 meals a day, and then you're allowed to kind of have a half an hour break after the meal. But otherwise, between meals, like 3, sometimes 4 hours, I think, you're supposed to just sit and not move. And it's a kind of Zen thing. the people who believe in the innate perfection of everything, you sit there with perfect pain. I've done that too. I've gone through it twice, a few times actually. She called forth these tremendous resources inside herself to sit through those 5 days, and she feels that, you know, that becomes a resource. You know, she's been through that at least. She said, it'll be the same. I don't know. Yes.
So this is second pregnancy, but in my first, I can't have an epidural because I have spinal surgery. So my choices were to either. They can give you like Demerol, which kind of holds you, or put you under. And the idea of getting put under for birth is so horrible to me. I have to tolerate the pain, and so I have to find a way, you know, to tolerate the pain. And sometimes having the choice of, you know, coming in with this easy solution to make it go away prevents you from making that effort.
Very good. In Vipassana practice, where we err on the side of taking care of ourselves, you always have going to Vipassana retreat. There's always an easy option out. You can go take a bath, or go take a nap, or whatever. And in Zen, there's no option, no way out. You know, once you're sitting there, you're there, you're committed. You can't, you know, unless you leave the whole thing, and you know, it's just terrible. You know, you're not supposed to leave, but you just, you know. So I'm very grateful for my Zen training, because when I was young, I was trained in a situation where there was no out. I preferred right the safer way, because people can get damaged when there's no way out. But it is a problem sometimes in the Vipassana world that people take the easy way out too quickly and don't really hang in there, when actually it would be serving them the best to hang in there and really face what's going on, really sit still and be present. That. I wish you well with that. I'm excited for you. When is it?
December 5th.
December 8th is the, in the Japanese Buddhist tradition, the date of the Buddha's enlightenment. And all across the world, Zen students stay up all night hoping to give birth to something. Okay, well, I hope this has been useful. If not, yeah, Jill, last one.
Oh, I just wanted to add one thing which actually affects both men and women in terms of pain, which is when people go to the dentist. And it's very, you know, common. You're going to get drilling, and so they just shoot you up with something, either Novocaine or gas or something. Sometime in the 70s, I just decided that I didn't want to do that anymore. And so it's a continual practice every time you go to the dentist, and it's a continual practice to explain to a dentist why you don't want Novocaine. You know, it's a foreign thing, but actually it's very simple to sit there and get most drilling done. It's very quick and. It's very intense. In a way, it's a microcosm of childbirth, because the pain comes and then it goes. It's not very intense, but it's really an interesting thing. So if anyone wants to try it, I have a root canal, and I still get Novocaine if I have to have a root canal or something. But you know, it's very much being present with them.
Yes.
Well, to follow up on that, I think what you were saying is the notion of having a fixed view of how it should or would go is important. Just the way you're saying, well, you have no choice. But sometimes I've talked to women who are going to have a baby, and they've not had a moment's experience of childbirth, and they say, no, I'm going to have an epidural. And that seems to me as difficult as saying, I couldn't possibly have an epidural. Yeah. But I want to join what you're saying, is I'm someone who, my feeling about the dentist was always immediately gas, just gas, you know, that's all I want. And I have a son who goes and doesn't get Novocaine or anything. He experimented with different things and found that he's most comfortable getting neither. Now, I could see the idea of childbirth without pain. People were like, good, because we know that natural childbirth is this wonderful experience, and I've experienced it, I know that too, but the idea of the dentist without pain, really responsible. Why did you do that? There's no beautiful outcome. This is just pain. But it may be that for some people, it turns out for my son, it's more comfortable for him than the other medical things he does. So I really respect that, not being passive and finding out for yourself what it's like to be present in that experience is worthwhile. Now, I haven't done what he's done yet, but I respect him for being open to trying it and then finding out that, in fact, the thing we fear so much, this dentist drill, for some people may not be all that bad.
The beautiful outcome is you don't drool at it.
So symbolically, may none of us ever drool. Thank you.